Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Because of the UK's role in the UN Security Council, you know, there are settings where we can be a sort of proxy for the United States. And that partly means that a lot of other allies are also would be looking to us to sort of step in and step up in the event that the US became a less predictable partner.
Democracy still has a legitimacy that very few people are willing to jettison. You know, the Chinese are probably the only large power who will say, no, it's not for us.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Rory Medcalf, head of the National Security College at the Australian National University in Canberra. And today's podcast has been recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay respects to their elders, past and present. So in this episode of the National Security Podcast, I'm really delighted to be joined by two very distinguished and very knowledgeable international guests. We'll be speaking about the global disruptions of 2024, but particularly the promise and the perils, really, of the polls, the elections in a number of democracies over the world this year. I think the year in which more people will vote for their leaders in 1 year than at any other time in human history, although I'm happy to have that little piece of data checked by our expert visitors. My guests will be well known to many listeners of the National Security Podcast. Gideon Rackman, Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator for the Financial Times. Welcome, Gideon.
Thank you.
And also Sophia Gaston, who's Head of Foreign Policy at the Policy Exchange think tank in London, also an expert associate of the National Security College, and someone who pays particular attention to Australia and the Australia-UK relationship. Welcome, Sophia.
Thanks, Rory.
So Sophia and Gideon are both here in Canberra visiting the National Security College and sharing their wealth of expertise and insight with policymakers and our scholarly community. And so it was a perfect opportunity to bring you into the studio and really pick your brains on what's happening in the world, but particularly, as we say, the perils, the promise, the potential of this extraordinary democratic moment in this time of great disruption and risk in the geopolitical environment. There are plenty of countries we could begin the conversation with that have either gone to the polls or are going to the polls, and of course, among other places where democratic elections have been held that are quite momentous lately has been Taiwan, Indonesia. The list could go on. But I might go to you first, Gideon, because your work looks not only at democracy, but of course also at authoritarianism. What's your take on the world in 2024?
Well, I think that, as you say, at least on the surface, this looks like almost a celebration year for democracy. Huge numbers of people voting, the world's most populous democracies, India, Indonesia, the United States, all having elections. But I think beneath the surface, the picture's a bit less comforting, because even as you have these elections, I think you can make a case that there's a big danger of democratic erosion, that the winners of these elections are the kinds of people who may ensure that the next election, while it might take place, might be less free and fair, or even if electoral democracy survives, some of the other aspects of a kind of free society, whether it's independent courts, independent media, get eroded. And this is a phenomenon that's associated with this strongman leadership that I've written about in the past. But to give you a bit more detail, let's take a few of these, particularly Indonesia, India, Mexico, and I'm sure we'll talk about the US in more detail later. Indonesia, we just had an election. Prabowo won a very clear victory. I think people were surprised by the margin. And I think it's also true that although, you know, none of the candidates were perfect, they all had issues, that he was the candidate who liberals, with a small L, people who were interested in the preservation of democracy, were most concerned about for a number of reasons. The first being that he has a record of having been accused of involvement in mass atrocities while being a leader of the special forces in the Indonesian army, working in East Timor, etc., and then subsequently was accused of being involved in the kidnapping of democracy activists, some of whom died or disappeared. Those accusations were taken sufficiently seriously for him to be banned from the United States for a while. I think in the pattern that we've seen with Narendra Modi, that bygones become bygones pretty quickly when you become the head of a state, and that won't be an issue in terms of visiting or working with Western countries. But they are an issue in the backs of people's minds. And I think even, you know, now Prabowo didn't run actually as a strongman figure. He ran as a sort of cuddly grandpa, you know, with TikTok videos of him dancing and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's not the whole story, though, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because people noted that, for example, he, unlike the two other candidates, skipped an event on freedom of the press. He did not answer questionnaires from human rights associations, unlike the other candidates. There are people who think that he is an admirer of Putin and in his ideal world would run the country a bit more in that style. So that's, you know, I don't want to convict the guy before anything's happened. Maybe he'll be a good leader. But there are those concerns. You've got to remember that Indonesia's transition to democracy is relatively recent. You know, Suharto fell in the late 90s. And indeed, Prabowo was married to Suharto's daughter. So that's one. Then India, I think, which comes up very soon. Again, it's this slightly contradictory picture, or it's not cut and dried. There's no doubt that Modi is extremely popular, that he will win this election. I think unless something astonishing happens, he's going to win very easily. And that reflects genuine popularity. At the same time, I think there has been a process of democratic erosion in India. You talk to journalists, obviously, as a fellow journalist, kind of my first port of call. They found the environment much more intimidating recently. People I know who've worked in universities have lost their jobs for being too critical of the BJP. There are other concerns about... obviously about the attitude to Muslims, et cetera. So Modi's reputation, I mean, he's certainly no liberal, you know, he is a classic strongman leader. He's built up a personality cult, you know, from calling the main cricket stadium in India the Narendra Modi Stadium while he's still in office. And I think one of the concerns is that if he wins this smashing victory, as people expect, I think one of the patterns I saw when I wrote Age of the Strongman is that leaders who are elected in a relatively moderate fashion, the longer they're in power, can become more extreme, more authoritarian. And that's certainly been the pattern, say, with Erdogan, with Putin, and there must be a concern that that might be the case in India. Then just briefly, Mexico, obviously, it's not one that gets that much attention out in this part of the world, or indeed, you know, even in the US, actually, even though it's across the border. But
they have a huge democracy.
They have a huge democracy, yeah. And AMLO is, again, he's a sort of Modi-style figure in that he's very popular, no doubt about it. But he's also, he holds a ranting three-hour press conference every day in which he calls out his enemies and so on. He is stepping down in line with the constitution, but he has a handpicked successor. A woman called Claudia Sheinbaum, who was likely to win. And there were big demos in Mexico City just recently because people are worried about the way that AMLO has gutted the National Election Commission, which is really, really important for ensuring that elections are free and fair in Mexico. And there's a worry that he, at the back of his mind, is trying to move Mexico back to something the way it was for most of its history, effectively a one-party state where the same party wins elections again and again because it kind of controls things at a local level. So Mexico, too, is a concern. South Africa, finally, is also having an election soon.
And that doesn't get attention here, I have to say.
No, and that's going to be a very, very interesting one because it looks like the ANC, which have ruled that country since the end of apartheid, will lose its majority. It's always had over 50% of the vote. The country is in a bad way. You know, they have massive power cuts. There's infrastructures falling apart. There's a lot of crime. So the ANC are losing popularity, but they will probably still get them. You know, be the largest single party. They'll have to go into coalition, and that could be a moment of either hope or a further kind of downgrade in the country's prospects. Hopefully, if one of the more liberal and better run parties goes into coalition with the ANC, they might shake them up a bit. It's a very corrupt party these days. But on the other hand, if they go into alliance with the economic freedom fighters, who are, you know, even more populist and anti-capitalist, things could go even worse for South Africa. So to summarize, you've got these like four countries that are G20 members, all of them democracies and counted in the democracy column, but all of whom I think there's a danger of them moving in a slightly more authoritarian direction post-election, or as in South Africa's case, just becoming much less functional.
And you haven't touched yet on the elephant in the room as far as so much of the world is concerned, and that is obviously the question of the United States.
Sure.
But also the United Kingdom. So I might go to you, Sophia, and hear your views on the US and particularly the UK.
Well, thank you, Rory. I mean, the UK elections, in terms of the political landscape, we've got the Labour Party have been in the opposition benches for 14 years now, and it will be nearly 15 years by the time they would be coming into government if they do win the election. They have been on track to take power. They've been pretty substantively ahead for quite some time now, consistently in the polls. The Conservative Party, you know, one of the extraordinary things about this Conservative term, they've had, you know, 14 years, as I say, but they've had so many different leaders in that time. And one of the things that each leader has managed to do is every time they come in, sort of say, no, this feels different. They've positioned themselves as a change candidate from their own predecessors in the party. So it sort of at once feels as though the Conservatives have been in power forever, but also there is this feeling of kind of lingering instability and that we've had a lot of upheaval and people are pretty exhausted. Now, there's not a huge amount of direct enthusiasm for the Labour leader and the Labour Party and their sort of manifesto. It's not a kind of Blair 97 moment where you had this extremely charismatic person who sort of captured hearts and minds. It's more a sort of feeling that the government, you know, maybe is sort of running out of steam. And I think a very important aspect of this is that the Conservative Party has really fallen apart in terms of discipline. And a lot of this really tracks back to the Brexit years, the really fever pitch moments of those parliamentary debates where sort of collective responsibility and cabinet responsibility sort of all broke down. And so they've become rather undisciplined and the British people are watching that in you know, on television every day. The Conservative Party is also being cannibalized by two other parties. The Liberal Democrats, which is, you know, has at times been a coalition partner, the sort of
The moderates, right?
Yeah. They're sort of basically pretty socially liberal, economically liberal. They're usually quite localized. They do very well in local by-elections. They are going to be challenging the Conservatives in the sort of moderate heartlands of the south of England. And then you have another party, which is Reform, which sort of essentially grew out of what used to be UKIP and Nigel Farage. In a kind of post-Brexit posture, is now kind of really mainly just focused on immigration and sort of some culture war issues. So the Conservatives are being cannibalized by the left and the right. It's been quite difficult for the Prime Minister to sort of keep all those factions at bay, and it has created a slightly sort of schizophrenic feeling to some of the messages that are coming out. He's being pulled in all directions. So there are a lot of people in Westminster who are keen to ensure that the Tories fight the election from the centre ground, and would probably argue that that's really their only chance to retain power. But all of this makes for a very dynamic landscape coming into the election. Now, I think in terms of the mood music, this is an election that is being fought with a very strong feeling of escalating geopolitical threats and a destabilizing global security environment, plus a kind of raft of social issues and tensions domestically at home. And then you're having to deal with those as a government in a time of really profoundly constrained resources. So this is not going to be a good times election. And these sorts of issues outside in particular are having a really, really big effect on the issues that the election will be fought on the battleground there. So things like immigration, energy, and the other big factor, of course, is that our election it is likely to be held in the autumn. So either in the kind of twilight of or preceding or just, you know, after it was around the same time as the US election. And that's going to have a really, really big effect on the discourse and the feel and the sense of urgency around our result. One thing that's very interesting, again, just to stay on this foreign policy point, people love to say, you know, no one ever goes in the voting booth and is thinking about foreign policy. But I find it difficult to see how foreign policy is not a really significant part of this election. And what's really unusual is that for the Sunak government, the current government that's in power now, their domestic record has been pretty tough. They have not really got many runs on the board. It's sort of, you know, they created these five tests and some of them have been impossible to meet and others, you know, have been sort of out of their control. So, but the foreign policy ledger has actually been very strong. So, you know, again, there's all sorts of ways in which foreign policy is going to be looming large. Just to touch on this US elections point, it's difficult to overstate how strongly the focus in Whitehall at the moment is on the US elections. And, you know, I think both sides of politics are really dug in on this, and there's a lot of scenario planning work going on in government.
So this is scenario planning in the UK?
In the UK.
About the potential outcome of the US election.
Exactly. And, you know, we should take a step back and realize how kind of extraordinary that is, because the United States is our absolutely indispensable, vital security ally in the United Kingdom. So to be having to think about the outcome of their domestic presidential election in those terms, really, you know, we are in sort of uncharted terrain here. But I think that the implications of the US election are particularly large for the UK because we are so deeply integrated, and, you know, we are still in a process of having to deal with all the shockwaves of the kind of economic decoupling from our largest trading partner with the EU. And I think the question of whether or not we would have to, you know, or be forced to decouple in any kind of security or strategic terms from the United States is just a pretty overwhelming thought. But, you know, because of the UK's role in the UN Security Council, our role as the sort of pen holder in a lot of multilateral forums in diplomatic terms, you know, there are settings where we can be a sort of proxy for the United States. And that partly means that a lot of other allies are also would be looking to us to sort of step in and step up in the event that the US became a less predictable partner. So I think, you know, this is going to be a really extraordinary election in the UK, not necessarily because of the personalities between the two men who are going to put their names on the, you know, in the ballot box. They, you know, in many ways, we are fortunate compared to a lot of our allies that we will have two moderates, two pretty sensible party leaders going head to head. But because international events are creating such a profound sense of insecurity in the electorate. And because of this coordination of the timing with the United States election, it's hard to think of another time in recent history where you know, foreign policy will have loomed so large.
So the prospect of a UK Labor government and potentially a Trump administration in the United States, that really is uncharted territory, how that's navigated in terms of interests and indeed values, ideology, the whole lot. Gideon, what's your take, not only on that US-UK dimension, but let's go, sadly, depressingly perhaps, to the possibilities in the United States on the US dimension itself?
So, look, I think I don't have any special insight into how the election's going to go. All I can say is if you look at the opinion polls or indeed the bookmakers' odds, Trump is the favorite at the moment. He's regularly 3 or 4 points ahead of Biden. And given the bias in the U.S. Electoral College, actually a Democrat has to be sort of fairly ahead of a Republican to win. So it's not looking good for Biden. That said, we're a few months out yet, and Trump's trials are a big wild card. He's just been, you know, close to bankrupted by a New York court. I don't know what effect that'll have on his mental stability. Not that there was that much in evidence to begin with, but, you know, and will Jack Smith, the guy who's going after him in Washington, manage to get the case off the ground? Depends a bit on the Supreme Court. But so those are real wild cards. On the slightly more kind of predictable end of things, the American economy is actually pretty strong, and it's possible consumer sentiment may improve. Will people give Biden some of the credit for that? I think also the Democrats are beginning to find a strategy around the sense that the Republicans' use of major political issues for political ends, I'm thinking particularly of Ukraine and the southern border, is becoming quite evident. The fact that they will not pass this package for Ukraine, even though polls show a majority of Americans do want it to go through, the fact that they did not agree border legislation. Now, of course, the Republicans will have talking points as to why it was inadequate and they couldn't agree it. But I think Biden is going to try and run on those issues, that this is a kind of do-nothing wrecker Congress and wrecker party, which I think actually is a fair enough as a critique. Even so, I'd say, you know, maybe it's just my inner pessimist, but I think it's quite likely that Trump will win. And then really all bets are off, because there are some optimists who say, well, we had 4 years of Trump. We kind of know what it's like, a bit, you know, crazy and disruptive, but actually good in some ways. And but I think Trump 2 will be very different from Trump 1. He personally has been radicalized by the experience of January the 6th, all the trials. He's much more into sort of, I mean, he was always a bit into conspiracy theories. I mean, he started with a conspiracy theory that Obama had not been born in the United States, but he's gone further down that sort of rabbit hole, taking a lot of his followers with him. And I think he has said, I will be your revenge. So if he comes in on a revenge mission, starts trying to do things like put Mark Milley, the former head of the Joint Chiefs, on trial, which is something he's threatened to do. He's really taking on, as he would see it, the deep state. I would just say the state. Mm. And if he takes on the US military, which is something people in the Pentagon are worried about, that he's going to try and take out not just Milley, but a lot of the top brass who you don't, and replace them with people who are loyal, so that he can then use the army.
I see the air quotes there, loyal.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Loyal to him, exactly. Mm. Sorry, you can't see air quotes in the podcast, can you? Yeah, so that he's after having loyalists in place and not, as he would put it, the best. You know, they would be people who'll do what he says, won't, you know, even some of the real loyalists in the past, people like Bill Barr at the Attorney General, Pence as vice president, they had a line they wouldn't cross, to their credit. But maybe he'll find some guys who don't have those lines.
So this is all occurring in a world of, you know, to put it politely, great uncertainty, but it's really worse than that. It's about disorder. It's about the intersection of zones of conflict, outright war in Ukraine, warfare of various kinds in the Middle East as well, the increasingly worrying risk of coercion leading to conflict or confrontational conflict in the Indo-Pacific. And liberal democracies have, especially middle powers, I think have a great incentive to try to band together as much as possible to manage these risks. I wonder if either of you could comment on how you see the potential interplays of the outcomes of these results. I know this is a bit of a probability maze of how different election results will intersect with one another, but what are the patterns and what does that mean for the way that countries like Australia or Britain need to get ready? I don't mind who's ready to answer that, but maybe, Sophia, if you've got an answer, that would be great.
I think one of the developments that had started to dawn on us after Russia's invasion of Ukraine and, you know, is the fact that there's this sort of authoritarian bearing witness to and learning from the behavior of other powers in these sorts of scenarios. You know, I think we certainly were aware that President Putin was watching the Allied withdrawal from Afghanistan. You know, I think there was a sense that he was sort of emboldened by that, a sense that the West was sort of had been proven to be ineffectual in that and had lost some of its power and prestige. You know, certainly President Xi has been watching the Allied defense of Ukraine and Russia's sort of strengths and weaknesses in that, you know. So I think there's this bearing witness, and then there's also the question about the interrelationships of the supply of support and sustainment between different authoritarian leaders and states with these different multiple spheres of conflict. So, you know, there's Iran sending drones to support Russia's offensive in Ukraine, obviously Iran's relationship with Hamas, funding and supporting Hamas in their October 7th attack on Israel and the ongoing conflict now in Gaza. You have, you know, President Xi offering quite significant economic support to Russia. So these interrelationships between these otherwise disparate spheres of conflict through these actors is an extremely worrying trend. But the bearing witness point is important because that's an opportunity for the West. It's an opportunity and a responsibility. It's why, you know, for anyone that cares about stability and security in the Indo-Pacific region, the outcome of what happens in Ukraine and the way in which Russia is held to account for its aggression, its territorial aggression, and its complete lack of respect for sovereignty is so important because, you know, President Xi is watching very closely and making interpretations and conclusions about that in the context of Taiwan and his other sort of regional intentions. So I think all of this is terrifying on one level, no doubt. But we do need to be really aware of those interconnected relationships and the opportunities and requirements that stem from that for us to make sure that we are really consistent and strong in the way that we send messages about the international order and that needing to be upheld, not just in our own immediate region, but also in other parts of the world. And I think actually Japan has been really extraordinary at this. We've just seen the announcement of further big funding settlement to Ukraine. They've been doing so much work directing resources towards the defense of Ukraine, often with very little soft power benefit, you know, relatively under the radar. But they're doing that because they understand the indivisibility of these two security theaters and that even though Ukraine is not in their neighborhood as it is for us in the UK, that if they're not supporting that, then it's more difficult to make the case for European powers for why they need to care about the stability of the Indo-Pacific region.
Gideon.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this question of these sort of interconnected crises is a very important one. So there's a sort of debate going on, you know, here in Canberra, I think, but also in Washington and in London about how much is what's happening in Europe associated with what's happening in Asia? And if you're sitting in the US, there's a school of thought, some people who I think would quite like to work with Trump, who say, well, you know, just leave Europe to cope on its own, that America should either retreat into a new form of isolationism or should concentrate on the challenge of China because they don't have the resources to police the whole world. And that's the key. And then there's a counter school of thought that says, no, you've got, you know, if you see the terrain in Ukraine, as Sophia was saying, she's watching that, and you actually make trouble in Asia more likely. And I think that's the dominant school of thought, certainly among the Democrats. I don't know which way Trump will keep saying this. I don't know which way Trump will jump on that kind of thing if he comes to power. But I think that the U.S. does raise a valid point about resources, you know, that it is a bit of a shell game, that America understands there's a credibility issue, that if it loses in one area, withdraws in one area, like the Afghanistan effect, does that encourage people to say, well, America's looking weak, the West is looking weak. On the other hand, if it's challenged in all of the areas simultaneously, it doesn't have the resources, you know, so that you can see a practical work example of that, where some of the ammunition that was going to go to Ukraine was pre-positioned in Israel, and actually then it couldn't go because it was given to the Israelis. So multiple crises may, you know, reveal the kind of how thinly we're stretched.
Yeah, and there is, I guess, there is a question of preparedness there. I think the idea of liberal democracies being prepared for effectively a strategic breakdown, being prepared in everything from defense capability through sort of munitions stockpiles, through to economic resilience, through to, you know, popular awareness of risk. I think for many of us, there's still a very long way to go, and there's even a question as to whether populations could really bear that.
Well, one really interesting aspect to this is obviously we're having to have quite live conversations in Europe about whether or not the United States will continue to fund the defense of Ukraine. And, you know, this isn't an abstract question anymore where, you know, it's here, it's now, it's landed amongst us. I still think we are so far from where we need to be in terms of actually shifting gears towards the kind of wartime economies that are going to be required to actually deliver on that.
I think there's a fear that it's already too late, to be honest. I mean, I remember talking to somebody who spends quite a lot of time on the Ukrainian battlefront, and he said, you know, it's a bit like that old saying about people going bankrupt slowly and then very fast, that with Ukraine, as he put it, by the time we've realized there's a real problem, it'll be too late.
But the really interesting thing is that we could probably all, I mean, with extraordinary domestic sacrifices, cobble together the funds to be able to fill that gap more quickly than we would be able to fill the gap in industrial production. You know, we have spent the past decade talking about the modernization of war fighting. We've moved to slim down armies, you know, fewer troops. We've been investing in tech, which obviously the tech side of this is kind of non-negotiable. It's been really important. But Ukraine has shown us just how important those kind of nuts and bolts of basic munitions have been. And I think that I saw a projection the other day that it could take us up to 2025 to be able to kind of actually uplift our capabilities. But is that too late?
Yeah. I mean, I think somebody said to me that at the beginning of the war, Britain was manufacturing as many artillery shells in a year as Ukraine was using in a day, which gives you, and right now another stat, you know, Russia, for all us saying, oh, you know, they're nothing, there's an economy the size of Italy, they're producing twice as many artillery shells as the US and Europe combined.
As an aside, it is fascinating to see the Korean Peninsula, North Korea and South Korea, each in their own way, however indirectly, effectively supplying the two sides of the conflict in Europe. It's not a story you could have imagined in the 1950s.
Absolutely. And South Koreans have been quite important. But I mean, just on the sign of, you know, even before the question of whether the US would supply Ukraine came up in this very acute form we have it now, you could see the running short of artillery shells in the decision to give them cluster munitions over the summer. It was simply because it was all they kind of had left in the inventory.
We'll be right back. When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In a volatile world, Australia's strategic problem demands difficult decisions, licensed by an inclusive conversation. The ANU National Security College is proud to present Securing Our Future, a conference like no other, informing a distinctly Australian, people-centred vision of national security. Bringing together diverse Australian and international voices, we are bridging disciplines, professions, and viewpoints. Join us in Canberra on the 9th and 10th of April this year to engage with thought leaders and decision makers from government, academia, and industry. For more details and to secure your ticket, visit the link in the show notes. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
And this goes to the question, obviously, of whether or not we're working in a connected international theatre of strategic confrontation and struggle, whether that's really got a democracy versus authoritarianism character, or whether there are other layers that are just as important as that. It does bring us to what I guess quite a few of our listeners would be interested in, which is the choices that Australia has to make in these circumstances, or what we can do to really be as prepared for these troubling futures, these troubling prospective futures as we can be. I think one interesting observation to share is the question of whether, in fact, the best thing that Europe can do for, and indeed Britain can do for stability in the Indo-Pacific is to do everything it can to hold the line in Europe, as opposed to being more active in the Indo-Pacific, or can we do both? I'd be interested in that question. I'd also be interested in a maybe slightly more parochial way about, let's say, the Australia-UK relationship, because you've got the prospect of a Labor government in the United Kingdom, you've got a Labor government in Australia that actually has affirmed over the past 2 years that it can be a Labor government, a social democratic government, a somewhat progressive government, and yet reasonably strong in the national security settings of pushing back against Chinese influence and Chinese coercion, not as openly or forthrightly maybe as previous conservative governments, but nonetheless continuing all those hard national security settings. And so there's maybe a lesson there in engaging with the UK. So I'd be keen to sort of Australianise the conversation a little to the extent that our international visitors feel is important on the global stage. Sophia?
I think there is one interesting scenario that could transpire depending on myriad factors, but in the event of a Chinese invasion, a sort of kinetic warfare invasion of Taiwan, that the United States could actually be asking the United Kingdom to stay in the Euro-Atlantic region and defend the region. Because I think now we are in this mindset of the sort of linked security theatres and the sort of risk of further escalation and deterioration in other parts of the world simultaneously. So that's a kind of interesting framing thought. But I think it also sort of skims over the fact that when we're talking about deterrence these days, you know, we're not just talking about hard power. It's not just about Britain sending frigates down into the Indo-Pacific. There are a lot of other instruments that are really important, because really what we're trying to do is make the cost of attack, invasion, destabilization too high to bear for the aggressors. And the UK actually has a lot of instruments to play. Obviously our joining of CPTPP has moved us into the second largest economy in that, behind Japan. That means we've got a seat at the table for some of the really important questions on trade and economic statecraft that will be decided in the region. But I think what's really important is that As I referenced earlier with Japan, you know, I think Australia needs to be thinking about the enormous constraints that countries like the UK are under dealing with truly global responsibilities at the highest level, and these different spheres of conflict sort of coming up and pulling at our very constrained resources, and thinking about what really targeted demonstrations sort of in both material and symbolic terms can be made by Australia into the Euro-Atlantic region, you know, supporting the defense of Ukraine, you know, thinking about the Red Sea in the Middle East and stabilization there. So I think that's really, really vital. I would say that the change of government that is anticipated in the UK, the Labour Party have said that they will practice continuity on national security and defence, and I wouldn't see any kind of rolling back of what we've already done in the Indo-Pacific. I think that is here to stay. But I do think there is a question as to whether the Labour Party will reinforce the designation that has been given to the Indo-Pacific as our second primary security theatre.
After the Euro-Atlantic
as our home region. And so that's to play for. So, you know, there is a question and there is a conversation that needs to be had about whether Labour will be as ambitious on that, or whether they will want to, with these constrained resources, direct to some other areas that they feel are important to them, multilaterals, you know, Africa, other parts of the world.
Or indeed there's a major conflict in the Middle East where British forces have been, you know, participating with the US in the attacks on the Houthis, for example.
So dialogue between the sort of Labour Party establishments of the two countries sounds like it would be pretty beneficial to shared security interests.
Extremely important, because the relationships between the Conservative government in the UK and the Conservatives here in Australia have been extremely strong, and we still on a daily basis have a lot of Australian Conservative ex-politicians and prime ministers coming through London. It's quite extraordinary, actually. But we have far fewer from the other side of politics coming through, with the exception of, you know, officials.
Or the High Commissioner, who is a former Labour Minister.
And the High Commissioner, who's doing a brilliant job. But we just need to increase that visibility and make this more of a kind of bipartisan relationship, and really divorce it from that, I suppose, kind of psychological association with the Brexit moment.
I mean, I think that obviously that there's the question of resources. The British military is much diminished, even from not just, you know, imperial era, but even at the time of the Falklands War. I mean, I think we have a much smaller navy. I think I just read that the Australian Navy, based on the announcements yesterday, will actually soon have more ships than the UK Navy.
If we spend the money and get there over the next 10 to 20 years.
And the British Army is down to 70,000 men. So you could get them all into Wembley Stadium and there'd be 26,000 empty seats. It's not super impressive. And that's partly a recruitment issue as well. We're finding it very, very difficult to get people into the Navy, into the Army, as well as equipment and so on. And I remember, you know, one of my earlier visits to Australia, being at a dinner, sort of Anglo-Australian dinner, and an Australian military guy, fortunately, perhaps I can't remember his name, but he struck a discordant note, because a lot of it was rah, 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 we're going to work together, Indo-Pacific. And this guy stood up, and this was pre the major Ukraine war, and said, look, you face a major challenge in your own region. You don't have the resources to send half your navy to the Indo-Pacific. You know, maybe you should just concentrate on deterring Russia. And that was not the view of the room in general, but I thought it's always good to have somebody throw a glass of cold water at you just to make you think. And I think that that is a question we're going to face. If we have a major security contingency in Europe, which we may well do, if you have the combination of Russia advancing, Trump elected, NATO in disarray, how much will we really be able to direct it out here? But if that's too much of a downer, I think that some of the role that the UK plays here and that Australia plays in Europe is symbolic. It's sort of showing up. You know, so that it was important for NATO that Australia, South Korea, and Japan came to summits, because it made this point about this is a global community. It's not just the US leading Europe by the nose. And equally, I think some British presence here
whether it's in a naval exercise or it's a foreign minister's visit or whatever, shows that, yeah, we are thinking globally, that we are still a member of the P5, and that there is a community that stretches from the US to Australia to the UK and a bunch of European Union's like-minded democracies, in case it's all sounding a bit sort of, you know, like a white man's club, also in Japan, in South Korea, who work together. And that's important.
And as a sort of unashamed Indo-Pacificist, I also recognise that we need to build coalitions of as much like-mindedness as we can globally at this time. I can't end the conversation without going to AUKUS. And I think these, possibilities for the Australia-UK relationship, for our relationships with the United States, that obviously raises questions about how do we sustain, the extraordinary challenge and all the potential benefits of AUKUS that the three governments have set. Sophia, what's your sense?
We need to be devoting really significant resources to public diplomacy and stratcoms around AUKUS for the next 9 months. We need to be on the Hill in Washington getting, you know, GOP senators, representatives around the table. We need to be investing in understanding who could theoretically be coming into a Trump administration. We need to do all of that work and making sure that we can actually build some serious political resilience around this project. So that's going to be vital. We also need to make sure that we've got as many runs on the board in terms of the project actually coming into fruition.
In terms
We need some serious Pillar 2 progress to be made this year. It has to be the priority because the deterrence function only works when we're actualizing the project.
And so just to interrupt, just to remind listeners, Pillar 2 being the sort of critical technologies, not the submarine side of the AUKUS.
Yes, the advanced technology accelerator. These are really important, not just for military use, but they will also have civilian commercial applications, vital for economic growth. So we need to get that happening. We also, though, need to really understand and be frank about the fact that there will, while the US is such an important component of AUKUS, and it would be extremely painful and distressing to have to contemplate the idea of that not them not being, you know, a part of a trilateral partnership, that the reality is that the political instability in the US means we have to really, really invest in shoring up that bilateral core.
You're saying it could become AUK.
Well, awkward.
I'm not going to go that far.
I don't think that's it's not a short-term prospect that we're wanting to look at seriously. And I think, you know, we have many reasons to still be confident that we can make that case to build that political resilience. But I think the UK and Australian core of AUKUS is a really good place to make sure that we're shoring up. We need to modernize that relationship. And I think this is where AUKUS is such an opportunity for us to take this relationship away from colonial past, Anglosphere narratives, et cetera, into something that is really, you know, forward-looking. It's about technology, it's about security, it's about strategic relationship, and, you know, values, like-mindedness on top of that.
I guess I'd turn it around a little bit in that I think strengthening all of the bilateral pillars, and I don't mean pillars in the capability sense, but all the bilateral
prongs
within the AUKUS, the AUKUS trident. That's too much of a mixed metaphor, but you know, ensuring that the US Australia relationship, the US UK, the Australia US, we need strength in all of these, and even if there is therefore temporary weakness in one, we'll get the trilateral project through. I think that's probably the sense that I'm hearing, and I guess it sounds like the public diplomacy, but also the very sort of cold forensic sort of lobbying and information sensing effort in Washington is something that both London and Canberra need to be working on.
We have to make it really, really easy for the Americans to understand a direct national interest as well as a higher interest in the AUKUS project.
Gideon, what do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, to be frank, AUKUS is vulnerable. It's a very long-term project in a very turbulent world where a lot can change. And I think that the strategic analysis behind it holds up, which is that we need to work together to try to restore kind of the balance of power within the region. But there are the political technological side is difficult. There are questions about the durability of the support for it, particularly in the United States, because as we were saying earlier, it's just such an unpredictable thing. And there are people in the US who are reluctant, not so much as a political question, but almost as a sort of tech sharing question, to share tech.
Or to share the capability, for example. You know, the argument that there are only so many subs in the US system, can they spare a few?
Absolutely. And then the whole question about, we were just discussing earlier, do Australians really have the faith in the UK industrial base to build the final stage?
Share,
SSN AUKUS. Yeah. Will we be able to do that? And we all know that this is such a long timeline already, and we all know that defence projects are subject to delay and cost overrun. So I've had Australians outside the world of, you know, this world you live in, of the kind of security experts, say to me, we're never really going to see these subs, are we? And you somehow got to show that actually this can be delivered.
So look, there's so many more things we could cover, but we have a conversation that really began with democracy, is ended with capability, and AUKUS in the case of Australia, the UK and the US are seeking to prosecute submarine and critical technology capability. I think it's this level of critical scrutiny is absolutely important to ensure that the governments at a political level, and also in the agencies and the armed forces, continue every day to do that hard work that they're doing of demonstrating that this can work and of building the capabilities for our national interests and values in this contested world we've described. I do want to conclude on a slightly, maybe not optimistic note, but I think accentuating the positive note. And that's just to point out that if we look at the democratic elections this year, 3.5 billion people going to the polls, choosing their leaders, something that, you know, never before in human history have that many people chosen their leaders, you know, with that sense of personal agency at one time. Is there a silver lining that either of you might seek to conclude on, or at least an opportunity for us to capitalise on, Sophia?
I think for as much as we need to be really, really frank in our assessment of all of the risks that we're facing here and move pretty aggressively into a state of mind where we're really operationalizing our own agency here to shape outcomes, the world that we could be working towards in working much, much more closely with our allies and, you know, just being much more active and kind of muscular in our defense of liberalism and democracy after a period of, let's be frank, complacency around some of these things, I think is actually a really exciting prospect, and it's totally within our grasp. AUKUS is a perfect example of this. For me, it is the organizing principle, is the prism through which we, you know, as the vanguard of a new way of working between allies, where we're breaking down all those barriers, we're creating a domestic marketplace, we're really, you know, seeing each other as part of, you know, in it together. And if we can actually operationalize that, extend that to our other, you know, really important alliances, get serious about strategic competition and this resilience piece, bring our citizens on board for this journey and help them to understand their role in this piece of work as well. You know, I think we're going to be a lot stronger than we are now, and we're not going to feel as vulnerable as we do in this moment. So it's all within us.
Gideon, what do you think?
Well, I just think to return to the point you were making about voting and the numbers of people voting, you know, I started by pointing out that it's a slightly more complex picture. On the other hand, the fact that everybody sees elections, even Putin actually, wants to hold an election, even if he does tend to either kill or imprison his opponents.
And we didn't get to the timing of the killing of Navalny.
But no.
That obviously has a bearing.
Yeah, sure. But I think that it shows that democracy still has a legitimacy that the very few people are willing to jettison. You know, the Chinese are probably the only large power who will say, no, it's not for us. Everybody else wants to be able to say, we have the backing of the people. We had a free and fair election. And to that extent, the West sort of still owns that franchise, if you like, of saying, well, you know, our system, electoral democracy, is becoming the global system and is the system that people aspire to. In a way, it's why so much hangs on the US. In another way, it's not just will they back up NATO, it's also their role as a moral power, you know, that for all the things you could say about America, it had contested elections, it has a free press, and that was a real source of, and continues to be a real source of power. But that's why it's really important that that continues for all of us.
So look, Gideon Rachman, Sophia Gaston, it's been a challenging but also fascinating journey around this disrupted world in 2024. Thank you for joining us at the National Security Podcast, and we look forward to engaging with you again as we work for the interests, the values, the identity of our multicultural democracies. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Rory.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.